You've heard me talk about Morning Kick, used by former karate champion Chuck Norris. It's a daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes similar to strawberry lemonade, and I enjoy it. I know I don't eat as many vegetables as I should, but Morning Kick has helped me make up for that, and I feel great. I have more energy and better digestion. It's an easy part of my morning routine. My wife started taking it as well. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris today. We are live on the Conversations That Matter podcast at about 12:57 or so, maybe a little before that. I logged in to get the podcast started, and I got the black screen of death. And so my computer just totally froze and I couldn't do anything. Control alt delete wasn't working, so I had to restart it. So for those asking, you know, isn't John's podcast supposed to start? Yeah, it was supposed to start 10 minutes ago, but I had to get everything back up and running, and so hopefully it all works out. I'm not sure why that happened, but if it keeps happening, I'll have to do something about that. Maybe I'll have to switch to Mac. I know some of you that's your thing. You love Mac computers. I've been raised on Microsoft, so I don't know what I can tell you. Old habits, right? So anyway, it looks like we're working here. If you can hear me, let me know just so I can make sure everything's working. Someone says I'm on. Good. Okay. So we have the numbers climbing as people are coming into the stream. We're going to talk a little bit about this Anlie Stanley thing. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I want to relate it to something that I've been thinking about. And Jared Moore actually has a new book coming out on concupiscence, on the lust of the flesh, I think is the title. And I was skimming through some of the things that he wrote in there, and I'm planning on doing a review of the book, maybe having him on the podcast. But I think I want to play a clip. I might play it again in a podcast with him or a podcast on concupiscence in the future, but I want to play it today. And maybe we'll get started with that clip, actually, and we'll just jump into it, because this is a montage. I made this actually months ago of some popular Roman Catholic apologists, thinkers, and what they have to say about concupiscence, which is basically it's the Latin term for desire. It's their view of this, their view, especially when it comes to, this is where it gets, I would say, applicational. And the divergences are clearly seen on the issue of same-sex attraction. Their view is different than the Protestant view or the Reformed Protestant view. And so I want to highlight that a little bit before we get started. And then you can ask yourself the question, is what Andy Stanley's saying, is the basic error, or at least one of the basic errors, and I think it is the basic error he's making, related to this? Is he adopting a teaching that's not, it's not really a biblical teaching, or maybe even or a Protestant teaching, but I'm not saying he's getting this directly from Roman Catholicism, but at the very least, it parallels a difference that I thought was hashed out in the Reformation. So we will get into that. So Treadle asked if I saw the James White debate on Side B. I did not. No, sorry. I've heard about it a little bit. I think one or two people told me about it, but I have not seen it. So maybe we'll talk about that. I don't know. How was it? How'd you all think it was? If any of you saw it, let me know in the chat section here. All right. So we're going to start off with some clips. These aren't from Andy Stanley. We're going to get to the Andy Stanley stuff in due course, but I want to start off with some clips from some Roman Catholic apologists on this topic of concupiscence and specifically same-sex attraction. How does their concept of concupiscence and whether or not that is a sin to have desires before you're acting on them, basically, whether or not that is in itself a sin or sinful. So let's get there. Let's see if I can pull it up. Here we go.
Catechism, paragraph 1264. Just for the folks who may not know what that says, it says, yet certain temporal consequences of sin remain in the baptized, such as suffering, illness, death, and such frailties inherent in life as weaknesses of character and so on, as well as an inclination to sin that tradition calls concupiscence, or metaphorically, the tender for sin, fomes peccati in Latin, right? Since concupiscence is left for us to wrestle with, it cannot harm those who do not consent, but manfully resist it by the grace of Jesus Christ. Indeed, an athlete is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules.
The Catholic Church Catechism states, homosexual persons are called to chastity by the virtues of self-mastery that teach them their inner freedom. At times, by the support of disinterested friendship, by prayer and sacramental grace, they can and should gradually and resolutely approach Christian perfection.
The Church is not saying that the desire is a sin. See, actions are sins. Desires are not.
Because you can't be charged with a sin for something you didn't choose, something you can't be in control of. But once we have these attractions to whatever, then I need to choose how I behave.
So is concupiscence a sin? See, the Protestants confused concupiscence with sin. You know, that original sin is in us, and we are still in sin, and concupiscence is proof of it. It's sin in us, you see. That's wrong. It's not a sin in itself. Sin comes from the will. That's a very important point.
Okay. Well, there you have it. That's a number of different Catholic apologists and teachers, I think accurately depicting the doctrine of the Catholic Church on this question of same-sex attraction and concupiscence more broadly. And what you'll notice, and I think Andy Stanley goes past this. I don't think they would approve of where Andy Stanley's taken this necessarily, but what I'm trying to do is show you that their basic error that I think Rome advocates on this particular question is that sins can only be sins if they are of the will. That's the only place that sin essentially resides. So if it's there's desires, there's temptations, attractions, inclinations, whatever term you want to use, that someone can have for something that God has not ordained, that is wrong, that is sinful, were that person to actually carry out the desires that they have. But the Catholic Church has determined that those things are not actually in themselves sin. And the reason for this really is that once you're baptized, that in Catholic doctrine, the baptism takes away original sin. So when you still sin, right, when you still commit errors, there has to be a category for that for the Christian who's been baptized. So it's a willful sin in that sense. It's not original sin. And it's not something that if you have a desire for, you are necessarily guilty of. So they create a category there. And that's the reason they create this category. So essentially, someone who is baptized into the Roman Catholic Church, who the original sin has been essentially taken away, but there's still these sinful actions at some point. They can't originate from deep within because that's already been taken care of. I'm oversimplifying here, but I don't think I'm being inaccurate to what the doctrine actually teaches. And I hope to get into this a little more in some future podcasts. So. My point wasn't to get deep into Catholic doctrine in this podcast, but just to start it off with showing that this is probably foreign to you if you grew up in a Protestant church. You didn't hear this kind of thing, especially when it comes to the sin of covetousness. We were told in just about every gospel presentation, we were told that God looks at the desires of your heart, that the secret sins, the things that no one knows about except yourself, God knows about. And so he's going to judge you according to those things. This is probably familiar for most of the audience who happens to be Protestant. I know there are a few Catholic, Roman Catholics who do listen to this podcast and Eastern Orthodox. So if you are listening, hey, let me know what you think about my depiction here and where you think I could have. Well, I'm not giving a full description, but at least what you think of my description, my limited description here of concupiscence. But anyway, you heard the clips. That's what Rome teaches. Now, I want to bring this into the Stanley discussion because we're going to go over a number of clips from Andy Stanley. He preached a sermon last Sunday. Protestia had someone, I guess, send them the audio. So they captured the audio and posted it online. You can go to protestia.com and find that. I took the audio and cleaned it up more. So the link to this video, you'll find a cleaned up version of that, because in, I think the original version, someone was sitting in the audience recording on their iPhone or something. And so you hear some background noise and things. And so I tried to clean some of that out of it, but I'm going to play some of that clip, and we're going to talk about it a little bit as we go. So let's start here. Engineered all those years. Hopefully everyone can hear that. I'm going to see if I can turn the volume as high as I can for you.
This is the magnitude and why we're taking this time to talk about it. The confusion is created in different parts of the world, especially with missionary organizations and churches who look to us for leadership, and all of a sudden they read these articles accusing us of all kinds of stuff, and they begin to lose their confidence, and they wonder, hey, what's going on in Atlanta? What's going on specifically with Andy? So we decided to address it.
Okay, so I want to start by saying that this is an admission that outlets like Protestia, like this podcast, and like many others who have focused on Andy Stanley's errors have been largely successful in convincing Christians who maybe listen to Stanley that he's not correct biblically when he approaches this topic of homosexuality and same-sex attraction. And so this is something that I think is an encouragement in a way. At least I take it that way, that it does have an effect. You do have an effect out there when you share these kinds of videos around. And so Stanley he's forced to react to some of the criticism he's gotten, which we've talked about on this podcast before, for conferences he's hosted and things he said about this topic of homosexuality. So, and for those who don't know, I should probably say this too. Andy Stanley is the son of Charles Stanley, who was very instrumental in the Southern Baptist Convention's conservative resurgence. He's got a mega church, North Point Church, in Georgia, I believe. And he is a big name. We'll put it that way. So it's not like he's controlling an entire denomination, but you'll hear later, I think I included the clip where he talks about missionaries and others being impacted because of any connection to North Point and to Stanley, because of the criticisms against him from more Orthodox believers who are concerned about his stance. So an encouraging thing, just to get started here, that, hey, the pressure does mean something when it's good biblical pressure of this is what the Bible says, this is what you're saying.
That version of Christianity draws lines, and Jesus drew circles. He drew circles so large and included so many people in his circle that it consistently made religious leaders nervous. And his circle was big enough to include sinners like me.
So he says that Jesus in this talk, which is about 50 minutes, so I've taken about 7 minutes of it. You can go listen to the whole thing if you want all the context. But he says that the difference between Jesus, and I think he's reacting to an Al Mohler article, ironically, is that the criticisms against him aren't the kinds of things Jesus would say. Jesus wouldn't criticize Andy Stanley for embracing same-sex attraction as a legitimate category and hosting conferences that really do affirm LGBT-type activities and identities and that kind of thing. Because Jesus, he says, the pattern of Jesus was drawing circles, and that meant expanding the tent of Christianity into sinners. So obviously, though, the key problem with this, and I think everyone should be able to recognize this, hopefully, is that what he's doing is he's assuming that when Jesus sat down with sinners and tax gatherers who were repentant, who wanted to come to Jesus because they wanted the life in Christ that he offered, and they wanted to reject their sin for a better life, for the true life that Christ brings, that somehow that creates this legitimate category for living as a Christian without mortifying these desires somehow, with keeping these desires around, these sinful desires. You're not going to find that anywhere. Jesus doesn't expand to adulterers and to zealots who are involved in nefarious activities, tax gatherers, whatever the evil people of that time were publicly known as evil, had reputations of evil. Those kinds of people, he didn't say, well, you can be an adulterer still in your heart, but you just can't act on it anymore. And that's me expanding the circle. So there's adulterers in the circle. No, such were some of you, right? They were repentant. That was the whole premise of when Jesus told the Pharisees, it's those who are sick who need a doctor, who need a healer. So it was sick people who wanted to get better. And Andy Stanley has to kind of ignore that if he wants to make this argument about Christ, at least. Pretty basic stuff here, but somehow this is what's passing for preaching in Andy Stanley's church.
I'm going to tell you the backstory to the current story and then talk about our stories moving forward. So we got to go back in time for a few years. In 2014, Tom Schneffschunas and Kevin Ragsdale, who oversaw our amazing network of middle school and high school ministries throughout our network of churches, I think it was Tom that first came to me. He said, Andy, more and more middle school students are coming out to their small group leaders about their same-sex attraction. And we had already seen this begin to happen with high school students coming out to their small group leaders. And so Tom and Kevin said, hey, Andy, our small group leaders and our volunteers, they just don't feel equipped to talk to a middle school or a high school student about same-sex attraction. And would you put together a training to help our leaders, know what to do with this? Well, to me, that is an extraordinary win. This is almost 10 years ago. Once upon a time, I don't have to tell you this, once upon a time, the last place a middle school student or a high school student was going to talk about their same-sex attraction, the last place they were going to talk about it was where? Church. In church. And now they feel confident and they feel connected to where they can talk about the most sensitive area of their life with their small group leader in church. I'm telling you, I'm so proud of our church and our volunteers and this incredible system that Kevin engineered all those years ago that's so relationally driven.
So this is a double down. Stanley's saying that everything that's happened at North Point Church in regards to this issue has yielded positive fruit. And so that fruit, though, is manifested in the approachability of the leadership. So people with same-sex attraction are willing to come and talk about it to the leadership. And that is his measure of success. And so I will just note that if that is the only measure of success, at least, there's a major problem, because you can have people are feel very affirmed and approached, able to approach leaders in just about any secular, academic, or I guess media, or really any medical establishment, any institution you can think of outside the church. About now in 2023, people feel fairly confident talking about their homosexuality. So you have to look at this as if Andy Stanley is saying, we've caught up to them. We're just like them now, in that sense, that people feel confident talking about something that before caused so much shame, but now they're willing to do that. And I do want to say, there is this, there is a truth to, if someone's a repentant sinner and they're coming to you saying, I have a problem, you do want approachability in your church. That's absolutely true. You don't want there to be such a climate of, like a condemnation for someone who's actually trying to repent from a sin. But at the same time, that those conversations need to be about the repentance and about solving the issue, right? And it not just making the metric talking about it and they feel comfortable, well, good. And there should be some shame attached to some of this. It should be something that, you don't really want to talk about necessarily, because it's embarrassing. It's shameful. I mean, those public shame is a powerful force. It's actually can be a very good thing when it's when it corresponds with God's plan and his law, because it's what actually prevents people from going farther than they would, because they, that might be the last line of defense, but they don't want to suffer the embarrassment of doing something that people consider evil and shameful. So there should be some shame, but despite the shame, there should be an approachability for those who want to actually repent. Is that what Andy's talking about? He's not really making those qualifications, but he's just making the conversation is happening, and that means that we're in the right spot somehow.
Truth is, the majority of gay adults acknowledge that at some point in their lives, they ask God to take it away. In my experience, I've talked to many, 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 many gay men in particular. And I would say they don't just ask God to take it away. They beg God to take it away. they weep and ask God to take it away. They're afraid of disappointing their parents. Depending on the church that they attend, they are literally afraid they are going to heaven. Not because of anything they've done, but because of who they are, because of the message, not of culture, the message, the church.
Okay, so we've heard this so many times. We've talked about it on this podcast in particular, this idea that because people who experience same-sex attraction, because they're embarrassed about it, they feel, in the context of the church, they feel somehow judged by it and those kinds of things, that there's all these negative consequences that come from that. And it's just a horrible thing that there's churches that harbor these kinds of sentiments against same-sex attracted people. This is where you get living outs audit to make sure your church is safe, right? For this, that's Sam Albury's, I guess, organization. He was at least a co-founder in, and Tim Keller was one of the ones who was instrumental in bringing that out years ago to help churches navigate this issue by being sensitive to those kinds of feelings. But they're not, they're focused. If you notice, the focus is shifted. It's on man. The focus is totally on how does man feel in this particular situation? Is there a way to make them feel more comfortable instead of looking at, okay, what does God say about this? We wouldn't really do this with any other sin. And I think that holds true for every clip I'm going to play here from Andy Stanley. You know, substitute any other sin that's the world, let's say, considers really bad, and it would make no sense for a church to then soft pedal it or try to be so sensitive to the people who commit that sin and are fine with it, I guess, having those desires still to commit that sin and want to be affirmed in that somehow, being comfortable and feeling accepted in a Christian situation. Let's play the next clip here.
Ours should be the last generation of parents and families in the local church who go through this experience feeling isolated and without help. In other words, let's put an end to this. Let's create communities inside of our church where, again, as I said to that group, you know, almost 10 years ago, the church should be the safest place on the planet for students to talk about anything, including same-sex attraction. And the church should be the safest place on the planet for parents to talk about anything, including their kids who are struggling with and wrestling with same-sex attraction, or their kids that have just come out and embraced the identity of mom, dad, I'm gay.
So the church is a safe space now, is what you're hearing. Which is really what I said earlier. I mean, let's catch up to what the world's doing. Let's make a safe space here for that particular sin. And it's just interesting. He focuses on that and he doesn't broaden it. It's not, maybe he would have given the opportunity, maybe in other sermons he has, but you know, would he take some of the sins that, or even sometimes they're not even sins, but they could be sin adjacent or connected to sin, or they might not even be sin at all. It's just the world happens to have their own metric, and in their metric, it's evil. But think about, like, you know, misogyny, sexism, racism, all the buzzwords, anti-Semitism, kinism. Think about even some of the sexual sins that are still considered taboo, like pedophilia or polygamy, right? And would you preach a sermon in which you would take any of those sins and fill them into that spot and say, someone with pedophilia inclinations, desires, we think that they should feel comfortable, and it's so horrible that we don't have a safe space in the church for them? It sounds kind of weird, even when I say it, because we know innately that that's something that's morally evil and it should be dealt with. I'm consistent on this. I do think people with those inclinations or those temptations, those attractions, those sinful feelings should go to their pastor, and they should talk about that. They should seek help, Christian help for those kinds of things. They should feel comfortable sharing those things in the sense that their pastor at least is going to help them through it, but they should not feel comfortable in the sense that they're going to continue to be accepted and their desires are going to be seen as acceptable somehow, and people aren't going to think less of them or think less of their Christian walk if they have those desires, because there's a problem with your Christian walk if you have desires like that. It's the lust of the flesh. It's of the world. Every Christian struggles with sins at times in their life, no matter what the sin is. But it doesn't mean that those things are somehow acceptable, or those things are somehow part of, can live alongside the identity one has in Christ.
So time went by. They wrote a book called Embracing the Journey. It's available. It's their story. Last year, Greg and Lynn then reached out and said, hey, we want to do a conference. We do all of our ministry, you know, digitally, but we'd like to do a conference that we can invite parents with LGBTQ+ kids, and we want to invite some experts to talk to them to help them take their next step, make sure that they're healthy personally, make sure that their marriages are healthy as they, you know, continue this journey with their precious children. And we want to call it the Unconditional Conference. And so, of course, we said, well, sure. I mean, we've been in this space for 10 years. Why wouldn't we host the conference? Well, as soon as they began marketing the conference, all the Christian critics pounced. What they said about Greg and Lynn was cruel. What they said about Debbie Causey and Al was cruel. What they said about you was cruel. You need to flee the church. Andy's a heretic. He's sending people to hell. You know, I don't know if you saw some of this stuff. Hopefully not. I look at it all. I never turn away from criticism. It's the only way to learn. And sometimes I go, huh. Hope heaven's big and we're different.
I will say this for those who are, gay affirming and they like what Andy Stanley's been doing. You should notice that Andy Stanley, even in that joke, he is admitting that the people who are his worst critics in his mind will be in heaven with him. So just saying, if Andy's trying to have it both ways. And so he's not condemning them to hell for their condemnation of what North Point's doing, but he is against what they're saying. He is against their criticism, even though he's saying he's trying to learn from it. Now, the book he's talking about here that's being criticized, that they used, they held a conference with these people, is by Greg and Lynn McDonald, and it's called Embracing the Journey. And I figured I would just show you one page just to give you a little idea of like the kinds of things you can find in that particular book. So here it is. This is on page 134. Over the years, I said, Lynn and I had attended dozens of weddings. Sometimes we knew the couple were very well. Sometimes we knew either the bride or the groom. Sometimes we only knew the parents. More than a few couples in those weddings had been living together for years before they tied the knot. And though Lynn and I believe that God created sex to be enjoyed only within the boundaries of marriage, we never avoided a wedding because of the couple's previous sex life. We never felt like our presence was somehow putting a Christian stamp of approval on their choices. So look where they take this. Knowing that about ourselves, Lynn and I would attend the same-sex weddings of our friends and perhaps someday of our son as a way of loving them and maintaining a presence and influence in their lives. So this is the kind of thing you find in this book. And it's important for me to mention this just because Andy Stanley's trying to make out that what North Point's doing is they're helping these hurting kids and hurting people who attend their church along by providing comfort and encouragement, and that they haven't really, you'll hear in a minute, they haven't changed their stance on marriage or any of these things. It's really just them trying to be what Christians are called to be encouragers. And part of, though, the encouragement, this is key here, is affirming things like that, saying, I'll go support my son's same-sex wedding. I'll go and be part of that. I'll go to friends who are participating in that kind of thing. I'll go to their weddings. And so it's actually endorsement. Like, it's not just encouragement to flee the sin. It's an endorsement of the lifestyle sin, the pattern of error that they are stuck in, best case scenario, and you're embracing it. You're showing them that it's not really that big of a deal, because you're going to, out of love. Here's the thing, though. Out of love, would you support someone who's involved in some kind of another sin that's equally, according to the Old Testament, toevah, it's abomination? Would you go and support another abomination because it's loving? I mean, look, I'll visit someone in jail if they commit a crime, if they steal something or they rape someone or they rob. Or I mean, these are all still things that, you know, most people would agree are bad, thankfully, and they are. I would go visit someone in jail, but I'm not going to go while they are in the midst of committing the crime and clap for them or make my give them an approval by showing up and not trying to stop them. Or, you know, when the objection phase comes up, is there anyone who would, well, if that still comes up in ceremony, so is there anyone who would object to this marriage? You know, you're obligated if you're in the audience. I mean, you have to, like, that's just, there is an objection. Of course there is. So let's keep going here with Andy Stanley and just listen to every clip was terrible. Just every clip has so many holes in it. But we're going to continue here. We're about maybe 33% through the clips that I had queued.
On our side, you can find individuals who believe just about anything, everything, and nothing. The better question, perhaps, is this question. What do we teach? What do we teach your children, your grandchildren? What do we teach about these issues? And it's the same thing we have taught for 28 years. Nothing has changed. Again, I tell you all the time, Sandra and I raised our kids in these environments. We are thoroughly satisfied customers. And the thought that somebody is leaving our church over misinformation and pulling their kids out of our fabulous environments, that breaks my heart. Their parents are going to be fine. You can find good preaching, you know, just about anywhere. But the environments that we've created for kids, are they are the best. Again, thoroughly satisfied customers. But as it relates to sexuality, here's what we teach. And hopefully you know this. I feel like if you've been coming for a while, there should be no question about this, but I don't mind just putting it out there. We teach what I refer to as a New Testament sexual ethic. In fact, I wrote a whole book about this, The New Rules for Love, Sex, and Dating. My son Andrew calls it Loving, Sex, and Dating. I'm like, that's not the name of the book. It's The New Rules for Love, Sex, and Dating. Anyway, so
he's talking about, he's trying to show that there's been a consistency. He's saying, we here at North Point Church have not changed anything. People are just, I guess, woke up one morning and decided to attack us. You know, why didn't they attack us 15 years ago? We've been saying the same thing. Well, the fact is they haven't been. They've been moving in a certain direction. But his defense is that here's what the New Testament teaches and here's what we affirm. And so if you remember from previous episodes, Andy Stanley does not think Christians are bound to follow Old Testament law at all. Even the moral principles there, it's really strictly New Testament. He's really heretical on that topic. I don't know how else to frame it. And so when he says New Testament ethic, he's trying to limit it to what the New Testament says. Of course, the New Testament, though, imports the categories from the Old Testament. That's inescapable. The original audiences would not have understood, especially the Jewish audiences, what these categories are, what porneia encapsulated when Jesus talked about it. They knew because they already had the Old Testament playing in their minds. They knew what it was talking, what Jesus was talking about. So I'll let Andy continue here and you can listen to his defense.
From middle school to high school to college to singles to marriage to single again, every age and stage of life, this is what we teach. Whether a student is straight or gay or questioning, this is what we say. Hey, if you're going to follow Jesus while you're figuring this out, if you're going to follow Jesus as you struggle with your identity or some of the things you're feeling, if you're going to follow Jesus, here's what it looks like sexually to follow Jesus. And the reason your Heavenly Father has called you to live this way is because He loves you. Here it is. It's just three statements. Number one, honor God with your body because the Holy Spirit lives in you, and your body is how people know what you believe and where you stand. And your behavior through your body is to exemplify the goodness of God and the grace of God and the love of God. So you always honor God with your body and you always honor other people's bodies. Number two, don't be mastered by anything, not by porn, not by a sexual addiction. Don't be mastered by another person. Don't be mastered by your infatuation. Don't be mastered by your lust. Don't be mastered by anything. You have a master, and He's a king, and He loves you, and He created you, and He knows what's best for you. And number three, the old-fashioned one. Don't sexualize a relationship outside of marriage. That is so old-fashioned. No sex before marriage. Well, if you're not married, I mean, who even teaches that anymore? Always have. Always will. And when people think we've listened or, you know, wandered away from this, earlier this year, Joel Thomas did this amazing series called Intimate Encounters. And one of the messages, it was specifically about fidelity in marriage and sexual purity outside of marriage. And I mean, he just was right on the nose. And at the end of the message, at one campus at least, people broke out clapping. Like, yes, we're glad somebody believes that. And here's why we're not going to blink on this. And I've asked, you know, people in crowds this question. I've asked many people, dozens of people over the, you know, desk this question. Hey, has sex outside of marriage made your life better, or has it made it more complicated? Has sex outside of marriage made the person you had sex with, did it make their life better, or did it make their life more complicated?
So we're going to keep playing the clip, but just reminder for everyone, the three New Testament sexual ethic rules here are honor God with your body, don't be mastered by anything, and don't sexualize relationships outside of marriage. So he's narrowed everything down to these three points. Now, if you read what the New Testament says about these three points, if you go to passages like Romans chapter 1, obviously, is probably the standard and most, I would say, obvious passage where you find teaching on homosexuality, then it's disqualified from these broad principles. But this is a tactic that... you see people who want to somehow justify women pastors and other things that would be acceptable to the world and are kind of now seen as archaic in the church. That's how things used to be. They shouldn't be that way anymore. They often will justify things based on very broad principles. Sometimes it's nothing more than we're supposed to love other people, and that means getting an experimental jab, right? So that's what happens when you try to soft pedal sin. I've seen that if you're trying to justify it biblically, is you appeal to very broad categories, and then you insert in those broad categories what you think should be honoring God with your body, not being mastered by anything, and not sexualizing relationships outside of marriage. I mean, you could go through these and you could say, well, I'm honoring God with my body by being monogamous with this particular person of the same sex. I'm not being mastered by it because I'm not addicted to it. I'm not. There's other things in my life that I'm doing, and it's not causing a problem in my life. And then you could say, well, I'm marrying the person, right? This is the kind of stance the world would really have no problem with, this because they'd say, okay, yeah, you're Christian, and you're, you know, maybe some would think that the marriage thing's kind of old fashioned, but I think that's Andy's safety mechanism. He's trying to appeal to that to show Christians who are criticizing him that, see, I'm still old fashioned. I still believe in the biblical sexual ethics as you got to be married to have sex. And, you know, that's within the church, that's acceptable to the world, though, for most of the time, I would say people think, okay, if you're keeping that in the church, don't impose it on me. But if you keep it in the church and that's what you believe, fine. But you should never say that gay marriages are illegitimate or they're wrong or sinful or that kind of thing. And that's where Andy goes wrong. So someone mentioned in chat, he's a Marcionite. Yes, that would be, I think, a fair description of Andy's view of the Old Testament. He definitely follows a Marcion trajectory, an ancient church heresy. All right, let's keep listening to what Andy has to say here.
And honest people say, yeah, it created some complications. Well, then what do you expect your Heavenly Father to say, who loves you and loves the person whose life you may have set back? What do you think their Heavenly Father is going to say about sexual activity, when oftentimes our sex outside of marriage makes you a liar for life, because you're never going to tell the truth about your past, because you're too ashamed? What do you expect? So, The message is the same for everybody. Sex is for married people. And regarding marriage, and this feels weird to even say this, but just make sure everybody knows where we are. We talk about marriage, or we talk about and teach about marriage the same way Jesus and the apostles did. Every instruction in the Bible regarding marriage references or assumes a husband and a wife, a man or a woman. So biblical marriage is between a man and a woman. We've never shied away from that. We don't change the words in order not to offend people. Now, here's what may surprise all of us straight people. The gay attenders in our churches, they aren't shocked that we talk that way. They aren't shocked by that. They expect that. They grew up on that. They hoped for that.
Okay, two things, because he's going in a direction here where he's creating a sense of sympathy or maybe empathy for the people who attend the churches. He's saying they're right next to you. They're in the pew next to you, perhaps. I don't know if they use pews at his church, but they're here among us worshiping the same as you. And yet, you know, they don't have a problem with anything I just said. That's what he's trying to say, is that, look, I'm acceptable to them, to gay people. Now, I just went through the three principles before and said, hey, you could easily infuse anything you want into this. You could even justify gay marriage based on what Andy's saying here. And of course, he's had people who seem to, at least on some level, endorse same-sex marriage, be involved in conferences, and he's defending it. But then he turns around and he says, at our church, we also do believe marriage is between a man and a woman. So if that's the case, then why promote people? Why have people come in to participate in conferences who are at the very least putting a crack in that? They are saying that go on a certain level, endorse these evil ceremonies, and do so because it's in the name of love. This is, I think, the dance that you're going to be seeing more and more from a lot of so-called evangelical leaders who, and not just evangelicals. I mean, this is going to be, I think this is in a lot of different traditions within Christendom. The Mormons have certainly capitulated on this big time. More and more, there's a pressure to somehow find a third way, find a way between the biblical sexual ethic, the true one that forbids the things the Old Testament also forbade. And at the same time, tries to harmonize itself with what the world is currently engaged in and thinks is acceptable. So, and there's all kinds of strange recipes floating around about this. Some people will say, well, inside the church we have this, but outside it's fine. You can even have same-sex marriages. And a lot of people are going down that road, and they think that they're going to buy time or buy acceptance by doing that. Some are, you know, taking all kinds of contradictory positions. Andy's kind of in that camp, I'd say. He's definitely promoting and affirming the desires, the same-sex attractions and all those kinds of things. And he does it on the basis of God hasn't taken away. People want to get rid of them, but they're not getting rid of them, and they're good Christians. And so somehow they're still acceptable. But yeah, I mean, they can't really get married, I guess. But again, I mean, even he's partnering with people who are to the left of him, according to what he's saying here, on this question. So I look at it as a trajectory, and the final state of the train that Andy's on is going to lead to a full embracement of this. But along the way, he's getting criticism because, look, he's got what was an evangelical church, and was at least the reputation of his father certainly was a strong conservative evangelical. And so this is hedging, I think, against the criticism. And I'm not saying he's not sincere in it. Maybe he believes this, but it's a direction that he's headed. This isn't consistent. He hasn't said these things. He didn't hold a conference on trying to somehow affirm and help parents with children who have these particular attractions and what they think of as orientations. He didn't do that 15 years ago, hold a conference on that and how to counsel them so that they can somehow affirm their kids and let their kids know that they're very loved. And that means also accepting them and accepting that's how they are made. I mean, that's what Andy assumes from the get-go. We already played the clip that these are gay people, right? They're gay people. They have that. And it's before any action that they've done. So he wasn't saying this 15 years ago, but he's acting like nothing's changed. That's the deceit. That's the poison pill that he's taking people on. He's saying that if you've been attending his church for a number of years, that, hey, nothing's changed here. You can still financially support us and come and attend and be part of what we're doing, because it's never changed. Guess what changed? The climate changed, the political climate. And that's why people are attacking me. That's nonsense. If anything, the political climate has gotten more hostile against Christians who have these views. So let's finish this out here, Andy's clip.
They pray for that. They pray that God will change them so they can experience that. I've sat in groups with small groups of gay men, 35 and up to 65. And watch them weep. Because they don't have family. They couldn't have family.
Listen to the dramatic pauses in there. I mean, he's really jerking on your heartstrings, trying to get you to cry, trying to get you to feel, to empathize, to, it's so horrible. This is such a classic tactic. I mean, like people like, Greg Coles uses this tactic of, you know, how godly are you? I mean, you must be so godly if you're foregoing some of these things and living as a gay person. So you're still living as a gay person. You still have that identity. You're still identifying with your sin, and it's not actually taken away from you because either it's not sin because it's in the category of desire, and that's the concupiscence problem, or you'd have to say it's not a big deal, something along those lines, right? And but then we're not going to have a family because we know what the Bible says about that. So we should feel very sorry for us. And when we choose to forego those desires, it makes us like super Christians. This is one of the problems the Gospel Coalition has had, is they've in a number of articles have given the impression that there's almost like a higher standard of Christianity, which is greater than hetero. I mean, here's the thing. I know plenty of heterosexual people, right, who are attracted to the opposite sex. And I don't even like using that language because it's not the biblical language is we are all designed by God to be attracted to the opposite sex. And those who have disordered desires, that's something to mortify. But people who don't have a problem with those kinds of desires, they actually do have a desire for the opposite sex, and there's no temptation in the other direction. I forgot what I was saying now. I lost my train of thought. I was making a good point. It was a brilliant point, but now I forgot it. All right. Let me see if I can get it back. So yeah. Okay. So people who are, who have these, who consider themselves to be straight and they're living a life, that is holy to God in that way, approved by God, right? They're pursuing things in the right way that the Bible describes that we're supposed to pursue them. When they get married, there's no problem. They're doing everything according to the biblical plan. When a homosexual person gets married, they're breaking the biblical plan. So a straight person can participate and a homosexual person cannot. But here's the problem. There's tons of quote unquote straight people who aren't married. Or they're older, they're bachelors, I have some in my family, some I'm friends that they've had to, and guess what they've had to do? They've had to be sexually pure for decades while not getting married. I mean, isn't that also a struggle, a real one, and probably and a more holy one in a way? I mean, because these are in principle good desires to have, but you can't actually advance them at all. Whereas in the case of someone who's homosexual, it's evil desires that you can't advance. And we're supposed to think that's somehow holier or that there's this godliness attached to that. No, there's not. Now, of course, mortifying sin, that's what all Christians should do. But it's not like there's a special category for homosexuals, though, where they are allowed to have this desire and this identity and these inclinations and temptations and all of that. And they should be held up and put in church leadership positions and seen as extra godly because they're not getting married and they're not participating in the physical act. No, I mean, those desires need to die. These are still very disordered desires. And my heart does go out to the people who struggle in these areas through their own sin or the sin that's been committed upon them by other people. And it's contributed to producing these things. They are... they are bearing a burden, but it is a burden. It doesn't mean that they're we should just, our heartstrings should be pulled in the direction of accepting that condition as if it's a godly condition, just because it's not a godly condition. The godliness is the fighting it. So
to that ungodliness in their prayer, and many are convinced that traditional marriage is not an option to them. So they commit to living a chaste life, an old-fashioned word. And for many men and women who put their faith in Christ, they just decide, okay, I'm just going to buckle down. I'm just going to bear down. I'm just going to be by myself. I'm not going to have family. I'm going to be sexually pure. And many do that for long seasons of time. And for some, it's their whole life. But for many, that is not sustainable. And so they choose a same-sex marriage. Not because they're convinced it's biblical. They read the same Bible we do. They chose to marry for the same reason many of us did. Love, companionship, and family. And at the end, as was the case for all of us, this is the important thing I want you to hear me say. It's their decision. Our decision is to decide how we respond to their decision. Our decision as a group of local churches is how are we going to respond to their decision. And we decided 28 years ago, we draw circles, we don't draw lines. We draw big circles. If someone desires to follow Jesus, regardless of their starting point, regardless of their past, regardless of their current circumstances, our message is come and see and come sit with me. And this is not new. This is who we are. It's who we've always been. And this is why I love our church. And this is why I'm so extraordinarily proud of you. We aren't condoning sin. We are restoring relationships. And we are literally saving lives.
There you have it. Literally saving lives. Some people are complaining that, rightfully complaining that, I guess, the audio of Andy is kind of low. So just so everyone knows, I haven't uploaded the audio version. I don't do that until I'm done. And I'll go back and listen. And at the very least, I'll try to adjust that for the audio version if you want to share that around. But anyway, what Andy just said, and I think it's important to focus on that last line. They're saving lives. Saving lives at North Point. And he basically justifies homosexual marriage at the end. He says, look, it's not because it's biblical. It's you got to feel sorry for these people. This is just the closest thing they can try to. They don't want to be immoral. They don't want to have sex outside of marriage. So they decide to get married in a gay marriage because this is the closest thing that they can possibly where they can exercise their desires, which according to, you know, our liberal mindset in the United States and the Western world, it's like tyranny if you can't express your desires. And so that's the highest good, is to express your desires. So so for people to be shamed for it or not, like that's a terrible thing. So he's saying that he's putting it on like a good, better, best plane. He's saying that, well, it's not the best, it's not biblical. But it's good. It's a good thing that they're doing this, that they're trying to not have sex out of wedlock, so they're getting married. I'm telling you, he's going to go farther into this. I mean, he's going to start finding that the Bible, in his mind, somehow endorses homosexuality and homosexual marriages and stuff soon. He's saying now, he's trying to hold on to the Bible by saying, well, it's not biblical, but you should not be so hard on the people that do that, because look, they're trying to do something that's better. It's better to have a commitment and fidelity than to be just, you know, having sex with anyone and a player and that kind of thing. So that's what he's doing. But I would say that's an affirmation right there. And that's where Andy Stanley's at. It's super sad. And I'm sorry to see it. We've been going about 53 minutes, surprisingly. I thought it was shorter than that. Time flies. So I don't want to go too much longer here, but I will take some questions. If you have any questions or comments about this, please get them in now. I know I should have probably flagged some of the comments. I'm going to try to find them if I can now. Some people were asking about the Roman Catholic concupiscence idea here. Now I'm having trouble finding them in the chat. If someone wants to, already wrote that and they want to put it in the chat again, go for it. Yeah, some really good comments here. John Grant says, if you keep my commandments, you abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. So yeah, I think that makes a good point about trying to somehow justify accepting sin based upon love. No, you can't. The obeying God's commandments is love. That's how we know that we love God, as we obey his commandments. And so that's how the world will know that you are my disciples. So you can't, making that separation between this is the command of God, but here's the love for somebody who's breaking the command, which means somehow endorsing that breaking of the command. It's not possible. And it is new. It's innovative. It really is. It's for this particular circumstance, because there's so much pressure on the church, I'm convinced. Yes, you're famous now, John. That's right. all 300 people streaming. Is Andy SBC? That's a good question. I don't know if he still is or not. That's a good question. I bet I could find out real quick if he's SBC. Because I mean, he's replying to a criticism from Al Mohler, which is would make me think that there's at least some overlap there. Whether or not he himself is still, his church is still in the SBC. Yeah, I'm not finding a confirmation of that. Maybe someone can put in the chat whether he's still in the Southern Baptist Convention. I'm not finding any articles. Yeah, it just says that I guess the criticisms from Al Mohler were particularly potent. So there must be some overlap there, because Al Mohler's influence is primarily potent, I would say, in the SBC. So good question there. Okay, so Sean Graham says, North Point Church voluntarily affiliates with the Southern Baptist Convention in its local, state, and national expressions. And he is, I believe, quoting from their website. So yeah, they are. They are in the SBC. Interesting. So yeah, this is a major SBC church, that means. A major mega church that is going down this road. So it's a problem in the SBC. Some people think that, well, it's the PCA that has the revoice problem. No, the SBC has it too. It definitely does. It's not in the same way, perhaps, or to the same extent, but it's definitely there. And I've seen it at a number of places. I mean, Sam Albury is platformed at Southern Seminary, right? So, which is the flagship seminary. So, I mean, it's around for sure. Lots of comments coming in. Is the SBC doing anything about this? I mean, you'd think that if they're going to disfellowship quote unquote racists, you would think that this would be an easier call, but this would be big. I mean, disfellowshipping Rick Warren was a big thing, right? So this would be also pretty big, because this is the son of a person of a major figure in the conservative resurgence, with a lot of respect. So maybe. Is Andy's argument the same reason God deposed King Saul? I'm trying to understand that question. Is Andy's argument the same reason God did? Maybe you can clarify what you mean by that. I mean, yeah, I'm assuming the question is, when King Saul was deposed for his disobedience to God, was it a similar rationale that King Saul used, that he was merely taking the cattle and the goods and everything that was supposed to be destroyed? He took them for himself, and he did so justifying it, that we're going to sacrifice to the Lord and that kind of thing. I guess I could see a parallel there, if that's the question, that Andy is trying to, he's not obeying the Lord, right? But he's justifying it based upon what he thinks is a higher good that the Lord also commands. So pitting God's law against itself, supposedly. Yeah, I guess I could see that. See other questions coming in. The Roman Catholic dogma of the perpetual virginity of Mary makes it clear that Saint Joseph led a celebrate, I'm not sure exactly. I'm not sure exactly what Babbery Lane is. If you could maybe rephrase that, maybe I'm just blind and I'm not understanding the question. There was another one and I'm looking for it on Roman Catholicism, but I can't find it now. And it's kind of killing me that I can't find it. I should have started when I saw it so that I could go back to it. But hopefully I'll hit it in my closing monologue here. So any other questions before we land the plane? Celibate. Okay, I guess the question was celibate. Wait, John, wrong. North Point. What was I wrong? Did I say Saddleback instead of North Point? I meant North Point. I was saying that. Well, what I was trying to say was that it took the SBC a lot to kick Saddleback out. So this would be similar, kicking North Point out. That's what I was trying to say. In case I said that wrong, sorry. People in the chat are going a little Sean's saying he was wrong now. So now I'm wondering, is North Point connected to the SBC? So he's got a link here. I can't really copy and paste that, unfortunately. But I guess maybe if someone could confirm that. I thought that he was putting a direct quote from their website. So yeah, let me know. Let me know if that's wrong. If they are in the SBC. Which to me that wasn't the topic of the podcast, so I didn't focus on it. But if they are in the SBC, that is kind of a big deal. Okay, so someone is now confirming they're not part of the SBC. All right, well, here live we have figured out that North Point has gone from the SBC to not in the SBC. Okay, Sean is saying he was incorrect, so I don't know where he got that from. There's another North Point. I got it. Okay. So we're confusing North Point churches now. So I'm glad that Andy's church is not in the SBC. There's got to be some overlap though, because Andy talks about this Al Mohler article doing damage and that this is affecting missionary support and ministries that they're involved with. So there's got to be some overlap here, I think. But I'm glad to hear that he's not technically in the SBC. All right. Closing, I just want to say this about this whole ordeal. You know, I started the whole video playing a montage from Tim Staples and others who are Roman Catholic thinkers, respected Roman Catholic thinkers, who make the argument. They have more than Andy intellectual justification for why they believe that desires aren't necessarily sins, even if the desire is for something sinful. And I think that is probably the root of Andy's problem, is that he actually agrees with them on this particular point, which is contrary to the Protestant understanding of desire, that actually our desires for evil things are in and of themselves, those things are sin or sinful. And so when Andy Stanley talks about being gay and having this orientation or this pattern of desires, but not acting on it, not sinning, he's making a very firm distinction, and he's trying to justify that having the identity is perfectly acceptable, but having the taking part in the action may not be. But even there, he's waffling, and this is one of the things I've said for a long time now on this podcast, is once you go down adopting same-sex desires, attraction as a legitimate category, the problem is that will naturally lead you to saying that the actions are also somehow legitimate. I don't see a way to really stop that, because if the desires for something is now somehow acceptable, you're going to then have to say that it must not be disordered. You can't say it's acceptable and it's disordered. Like it's either one or the other. So if it's not disordered, that means there must be something potentially natural about it. And if it's natural, then this is the question is this part of sinful original sin? And is it created from original sin, or is this part of creation and God's creation? Greg Coles, for I don't know why I keep bringing him up, but he keeps coming to mind. He's obviously a Protestant who advocates this kind of a view. I mean, he tries to make the argument that it's like a disability. So when God create that, this could be something that God uses to show forth his grace, show his mercy, and he uses these disabilities for but he's the one that created, you know, as he told Moses, he created the blind and the deaf and these kinds of things. So there is this attempt to categorize it as part of nature in some way, and maybe marred by the fall of sin somehow, but it's not actually tied directly to original sin in the sense of it's the consequences, but it's not motivated by it. And the Protestant understanding, and I think the Christian understanding and the biblical understanding, is actually that these actions are motivated by internal desires from original sin that are evil in and of themselves. And it's from the heart that these things come forth. As Jesus said, all the evils, the blasphemies and the idolatries and all of that come from the heart of man. So for the actions to be sinful, the desires for those actions also have to be sinful. And so there's these creative ways that I think Roman Catholics have been more consistent on this, and they're not as innovative. They've at least have a tradition now for a few centuries that does create a space for this, but it's wrong. It's in error, and it will necessarily lead people to the conclusion that this is somehow an acceptable part of God's creation. And if it's an acceptable part of God's creation, why not act on it? Why would that be wrong? I mean, the questions that come is, why would God give you then desire? They're not from sin. Why would God be giving you desires for things that you can't ever fulfill? And then paralleling those desires with good natural desires that's God's given, that are part of God's will, actually, his general will for all people. All right, so last questions are coming in here, and I'll just try to answer whatever I can. Okay, Tim Miller's trying to clarify his question. Now I don't remember what his question was. Let's see if you can rephrase it, Tim. I guess he's advocating prosecuting people who abuse children. I mean, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, that should be that has been traditionally part of our legal system. He says, you cannot sin without choosing sin, not how it works. Okay, yeah, I don't know. You have to, sorry. I don't do well with the shorthand sometimes. It has to be spelled out pretty, directly for me. Because otherwise I will misunderstand. Okay, so yeah, people are coming in and reaffirming that North Point is not part of the SBC. So good. Our nature is completely polluted with sin. Well, it's certainly, we certainly have total depravity. We also, though, have good desires that God has given from creation. For example, the desire to provide for your young, right? And the desire to have children, the desire to love your spouse and those kinds of things. They're, non-Christians can actually operate in these ways. Doesn't mean that their motives are completely pure. Their sinfulness, I think I could say attached to or part of even those things in the motives, if it's not ultimately out of gratitude for God and that kind of thing. But when Jesus said, even the unrighteous, even the evil father gives his son a fish when he asks for a fish and not a snake, that goes to show you that there is an earthly good. And that's probably the most common phrase I use is earthly good versus heavenly good or versus eternal good. Earthly good can be accomplished by non-Christians even though their earthly good though can potentially damn them. That's the thing that's if they're because they're not doing it again for the glory of God, they're not doing it with gratitude to God, but they are operating out of an instinct that God has given. And that's why when mothers kill their children, everyone says, "Well, that's like sociopathic. There's a problem there. That's a deep, dark thing, right?" Because it's the natural tendency of everyone. So that's, I think that separation has to be made here with same-sex attraction. Where do you categorize it? Can it be an earthly good? Can it be something that, well, maybe it doesn't God doesn't approve of it, but maybe there's some, maybe that's even natural. Maybe that's the case. Well, I would submit no. I mean, I think that's what Romans 1 is arguing against, that these are disordered desires. These are fundamentally unnatural, that there's no part of God's plan included that. And so the desires that produce the actions are evil. All right. Well, yeah, I do not know what you're, I'm sorry. Maybe it's my fault, but, if you rephrase your question, maybe I can, understand and get to it. I'm sure it made a lot of sense, but I don't know exactly what you're getting at. Oh, maybe it's this one. Because I see some people reacting to this. All right, this second to last comment. I'll take one comment or question after this. He says, I'm confused as to how someone can be sinning by having a thought, especially one they didn't actively try to have. Okay, this wasn't the normal view for 1500 plus years. Also, most people are same-sex attracted. I don't know what to do with that. Most people are same-sex attracted. I'm pretty sure most people are not same-sex attracted. So I would really be curious to know where that thinking comes from. Even the most hardened gay activists, I wouldn't think would make the claim most people are same-sex attracted. So maybe that was a typo. I don't know. But the normal view, okay, for 1500 years, I guess is someone can be sinning. Okay, so if someone having a thought doesn't mean sinning, yeah, but that wasn't the view for 1500 years. It's not that Protestants were innovative and they just decided one day, well, we're just going to reject. No, this is stuff that this was actually one of the dividing lines of the Reformation. Not as big as, you know, justification by faith alone in Christ alone through grace alone, but this was certainly an issue. Was the issue of original sin and the issue of baptism and what is the effect of baptism? You see some hybrid positions. I think the Lutherans actually have a bit of a hybrid position on this, but you'll see in the more Calvinistic leaning Reformation traditions, they would have rejected that. The baptism does not get rid of original sin. And then of course, what does that even mean? Getting rid of original sin? It doesn't mean that now you can have desires that are somehow, they're not rooted in original sin, but we get them. And those desires now aren't in the category of sin because you can't have that because original sin's already been dealt with. But if you act on them, then it becomes a sin. I mean, this isn't even a biblical, where do you even go in the Bible to try to justify that kind of thing? It's fairly innovative. But there's a lot of Protestants now trying to say very similar things. So, I do plan, just so everyone knows, I do plan to have a longer discussion about concupiscence. And the issue comes up every time I talk about it. I have a fly in front of me. I don't know where that came from. There's people who are concerned. Sometimes they have experiences where they've been abused as a child, and that's created problems later on down the line. So they say, this person sinned against me, so how can I be held responsible? And the fact of the matter is, I mean, people sin against us in all kinds of ways. I mean, if I was raised by a violent father and then I went and did violence against others, could I blame my father for that? Well, I could say that my father contributed certainly to the tendencies that I have and made it acceptable to me. And there was a pattern formed and a habit formed. But can I say that I'm not somehow now responsible for desiring to murder people? No. I mean, it's still a responsibility I have. I have a responsibility to mortify those things. So we've talked about it before. You can go back to some of my episodes where I talk about concupiscence, and I had Jared Moore on, but I think I'm going to do some more. I'm going to have Jared Moore on probably again, since he just published a book on this. And I might do my own podcast really going into detail on the Roman Catholic versus the Protestant historic positions on this topic, because I think it is important. And it does come into play in discussions like this. So that was a wetting your taste, playing those clips at the beginning. I'm going to play those clips again for you at a later point. And I know some people have asked me to do that. So one more. Did I say one more? One more comment. We'll do one more. Let's see. Well, everything now is just positive. I can't. I wanted a challenging one here. All right. Well, we'll just. Andy Stanley, his parsing on this issue is ridiculous, and he knows it. It's simply pandering. Yeah, I kind of agree. I hate to say it. I kind of agree. I don't think there's anything other than a pressure. Even if you go back in Roman Catholic history, you're not going to find the same push for specifically homosexuality, right? It's not like the Roman Catholic position is like, we're fine with homosexuality. It's not. I'm just saying that you can try to use a logic that they've had for centuries to try to create a middle path here. But no, this is a very new kind of thing to justify this. Very new. It's a result of modernity, really. I mean, it's within the last 200 years. And more specifically, really, in our context in the United States, I would say, you know, we're really talking within the last 50 or so years that you even started to see this kind of talk. It's so new. When I was doing research for Social Justice Goes to Church, a book I published a few years ago, I was specifically trying to trace in evangelicalism where this thinking came from, that same-sex attraction was perfectly fine. And the farthest back I could go with it, in any even semi-mainstream capacity, it wasn't, and it was even fringy what I was looking at, kind of, but it was like the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, it's so new. It really, really is. So, all right. Well, I appreciate everyone tuning in. And if you go to the info section for this video, you will find the cleaned up audio if you want to listen to it there on YouTube. You can go to Protestia and get the raw audio if you want to go to protestia.com. And I will be uploading a version of this for the audio podcast, and hopefully I'll be able to get those audio levels better that people were saying, I guess, weren't that great. So you can look forward to that and maybe share that around on social media if you think it'll help people. God bless. More coming later in the week. Bye now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.